Hello, I'm Alex Amon, your non-binary host, and this is the 61st episode of The Art of Asymmetrical Warfare. Today, I'll be talking about the Civic Guard Mutiny of 1922. First, an announcement! I have officially launched the Around the World Book Club! This is a book club dedicated to reading books by authors all over the world. And the books will focus on colonialism, decolonialism, asymmetrical warfare, and or a combination of those topics. The first book we'll be reading is The Shadow King by Maza Mengeist. That book is about the Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia in 1935. It focuses on the guerrilla war aspect, particularly the role that women played. It's a historical fiction book. Our first meeting will be March 23rd. Our first virtual meeting will be March 23rd, which is also the four-year anniversary of this podcast. Sign up for the book club newsletter to receive the Zoom link, discussion guide, and additional related resources that I share either about the book, the author, or the conflict that the book is covering or referencing. There's also a reading challenge on Storygraph called Around the World Book Club. So if you prefer Storygraph, you can join through there. If you join through Storygraph, though, you won't get the Zoom link and stuff. So if you want the Zoom link and the additional resources, be sure to sign up for my newsletter, which you can do on my website, www.samswarroom.com. To celebrate the launch of the book club, I am running a month-long special offer on my Patreon. If you join my Patreon any tier, you'll receive a limited edition Around the World Book Club sticker designed by the amazing Brave Burattino. You can see his art on Instagram and TikTok. So, if you join my Patreon now, not only will you be helping me maintaining this podcast, but you'll also get a really cool sticker from a really cool artist. And now, time for making history. So unless you've been living under a rock or are purposefully being ignorant, you will know that 1.4 million Palestinians are trapped between the Israeli army and the Egyptian border. They are trapped in the city of Rafah, and they have nowhere else to go. Israel has deployed a ground invasion and is preventing all aid from entering the region. Children, everyone, they're dying from starvation, they're dying from lack of medical care, they're dying by being bombed. A few days ago, Israel allowed one food truck to enter, and Palestinians, of course, rushed the truck because they're starving, and the Israeli soldiers opened fire and killed many of them and wounded, you know, hundreds more. The United States, instead of using its power to end the conflict, is airdropping food, which is ridiculous because our bombs are the ones that are destroying Gaza and killing the Palestinian people. The United States could easily stop this, but we won't. And if something isn't done soon, we're going to witness the live stream of the extermination of 1.4 million Palestinians. I know it seems hopeless, and you're most likely feeling defeated and thinking, what the hell was the point of the last 5 months? Millions of people around the world came together and called for a ceasefire, and we were ignored. Why keep protesting when it won't accomplish anything? I want you to take a minute with me. Close your eyes and acknowledge that feeling. Don't push it away. Acknowledge it. Feel it. Let that grief and that anger wash over you. Let it flow through your body. It's okay to cry. It's okay to scream. It's okay. Continue to sit with me and that grief and that rage. Think about why you joined the call for a ceasefire. Think of your Palestinian friends. Think of Bassan, Motaz, and Wale, and Hind, and Shireen. Think of the children. Think of Hind and Reem and Rahaf and thousands of others. Their lives still matter. 1.4 million Palestinians still need us. So take that moment to acknowledge your totally reasonable feelings of despair and rage and hopelessness. And then take those feelings and rejoin the fight with the intensity you had during the first month of the genocide. I don't know how long we have. What I do know is that we need to flood the streets, block the highways, prevent the shipment of ammunition and materials to Israel, harass the genocide enablers and supporters every minute of their lives, call our officials, call them out as genocide supporters, tell the Democrats you won't vote for Butcher Biden and his fellow genocide supporters, go to every town hall, every special event where Biden or your rep is at, and flood the event with questions about Palestine, and call them out on their genocidal bullshit. Flood the social media accounts of all genocide-supporting officials and companies and call them out for being pro-genocide. Don't let anyone, whether it be your partner, your family member, your coworker, your boss, anyone claim it's quote-unquote too complicated to take a side. Don't let anyone feel comfortable about not speaking out. We must continue to scream with the Palestinians that Palestinians' lives matter and Palestine will be free. I saw Michigan had their primary, I think it was either earlier this week or last week. I'm sorry, time has kind of lost all meaning for me. And they wrote uncommitted on the ballot. Instead of Biden, they wrote uncommitted. I would highly recommend you do the same during the primary. Send the message that we're not going to vote for Biden. You can't scare us with the potential of another Trump administration. Because right now there is no difference. Biden is supporting a genocide. He's enabling genocide. He's taking part in a genocide. You can't tell me that he's better than Trump. There was a huge protest yesterday around the world. There'll be more protests. If you want to stay up to date, the best site is the U.S. Campaign for Palestinians' Rights homepage, uscpr.org. Also follow them on Instagram. If you need a script to use when calling your officials, you also go to their website. They have a great selection of different scripts you can use. And now we'll ground ourselves by talking about the Civic Guard Mutiny. After the ratification of the Anglo-Irish Treaty, Britain withdrew its soldiers from Ireland, except for a contingent which they left in Dublin. This contingent was under the command of General Cecil Frederick Neville Macready. Not only did the withdrawal create a Barrett's race between the Free State and anti-treaty forces, but it also created a policing crisis in the midst of an approaching civil war. Obviously, the provisional government could not use the Royal Irish Constabulary to keep order, and even if they did, many of its officers had already fled with the British soldiers or were in the process of fleeing. Yet the provisional government didn't really have the bandwidth to raise an army, write a constitution, organize an invasion of Northern Ireland, placate the anti-treaty forces and the British government, and negotiate the terms of a general election with Eamon de Valera, and create a police force from scratch. The compromise was the Civic Guard. Part 1. Formation of the Civic Guard. Collins put together a committee led by Eamon Duggan to solve the policing problem. Which is kind of interesting because Duggan went with him to negotiate the treaty and Duggan hated him, so interesting choice there. Duggan's father was a member of the RIC, he fought in Easter Rising, and briefly served as the Director of Intelligence. Collins filled the commission with people he trusted, including two former RIC district inspectors, Patrick Walsh and John A. Kearney. Despite being former RIC men, Collins knew they were loyal during the Irish War of Independence, and he had relied on the information that they provided him while they still served, quote-unquote served, as part of the RIC. The Dublin Metropolitan Police was represented by former Detective Sergeant Edward Broy, one of Collins' trusted spies who helped him with some of his more spectacular intelligence-gathering operations. And if you've ever seen the movie Michael Collins, Stephen Ray plays Edward Broy, and there's that like famous moment in the movie where Collins marches into the castle and looks for the records because Broy let him in. Same guy. I don't know why they killed him in the movie, but he survived and he is now representing the Dublin Metropolitan Police. Originally, Mulcahy was supposed to be the chairman, but since he was a little busy with negotiating with the anti-treaty IRA and building the Free State Army, the chairman position went to Michael Staines. Michael Staines held various key positions during the Irish War of Independence and was close with Collins. His father had been an IRC officer, and Staines had served as a member of the IRB Council during Easter Rising. He served in the Dáil, and he organized the Belfast boycott. The boycott was meant to prove that Northern Ireland relied on the rest of Ireland for its wealth, and thus it made sense to keep the island united. Instead, it solidified the divide between North and South. Upon taking the position, Michael Collins told Staines that the RIC would disband on February 20, 1922, giving him just 3 weeks to pull together a proposal. Staines organized the committee into various subcommittees and submitted their proposal to the provisional government on February 17, 1922. The proposal was basically to recreate the RIC under a different name. The force would consist of 4,300 men armed with Webley revolvers. They were organized and trained following the RIC textbook. So I'm sure you can already see that some problems are going to arise from this proposal. Predictably, the compressed timeline forced the committee members to compromise and rely on old patterns. Collins loaded the committee with men he trusted and handpicked former RIC and DMP men. These men saw their appointment as a quote-unquote reward for their loyal service, and such, they felt they had a right to pick the top positions within the Civic Guard for themselves. Staines, not having enough time, or quite frankly, the creativity, relied on the ETS, RIC, and DMP members of the committee, and in turn, they relied on what was familiar to them. Finally, the committee decided that old IRA men would get first preference in terms of position within the Guard, and former RIC and DMP men had to be vouched by IRA members. However, the pay the former RIC and DMP men would receive would be reflective of their policing experience and their former pay. So even though the IRA men were given priority when it came to being selected, the men with the RIC and DMP experience would be paid higher. The committee gravely underestimated how this payment system would further deteriorate the already tense relationship between the IRA men and the former RIC. The provisional government approved the recommendation and empowered Staines to start recruiting 4 days after receiving the proposal. However, Staines did not recruit publicly because the provisional government was worried that they would encounter the anti-treaty forces, so Staines secretly reached out to local IRA brigade commanders, asking them to recommend potential candidates. During the initial recruitment period, a total of 1,250 men joined the Civic Guard. 94% were former IRA members, the remaining 6% were RIC or DMP members, many whom resigned from those organizations during the Irish War of Independence and joined the ranks of the IRA. Staines was officially appointed Commissioner of the Civic Guards on March 11, 1922. He had not been consulted about the appointment. He only intended to hold the role for 3 months. Sean Liddy and Patrick Brennan served as his senior officers. In March, Brennan was in charge of supervising a recruiting team and noted the difficulty in recruiting former IRA men because of anti-treaty IRA interference and resentment. Brennan reports, quote, "We got appointment officers in Clare, Galway, and other counties. In various counties like Cork, Kerry, Mayo, we did not get appointment officers, or if we sent them, they were arrested." End quote is from Brian McCarthy's book, The Civic Guard Mutiny. In March, the provisional government appointed 6 former RIC instructors as advisors to the Civic Guard, increasing tensions and mistrust amongst the recruits. The men expressed their displeasure by refusing to salute the former RIC officers, and Liddy reported that many Civic Guard recruits, quote, "regarded the RIC as their most bitter antagonists, and it little mattered to them if the whole provisional government or any individual members of it thought they owed a debt of gratitude to certain individuals of that now defunct and disbanded force." Quote is from Brian McCarthy's book, The Civic Guard Mutiny. Part 1A, The Protest Committee. The provisional government was desperate to create an effective police force and quickly so they could relieve the growing national army of maintaining law and order as a civil war became ever more likely. To achieve this goal, the provisional government reached out to men like former RIC District Inspector John Kearney to serve as Staines' second-in-command. Kearney was the head constable responsible for arresting Roger Casement during Easter Rising, and even though it's unclear what role Kearney played in Casement's eventual execution, the IRA labeled him enemy number one because of his involvement. 14 former IRA members of the Civic Guard organized a committee to protest the appointment of Kearney. They asked Brennan to forward the following petition to the provisional government. Quote, "We have competent IRA officers here that are in every way capable of training us in any way that we may require, since they trained us to fight the common enemy, England, under terrible difficulties. and I may also add to fight the majority of the RIC. That members of the late RIC and DMP must not be allowed to cater for us in the cookhouses or in any way have authority whatsoever over us in the future. That members of the late RIC and DMP must not be supplied with better sleeping accommodations or better goods than what we have. That ex-RIC and ex-DMP should not retain their rank and service attained during the rule of the Saxon, while there are IRA men here that have given 4 and 5 years service free to their country, and they are quite satisfied to lose both rank and service. That all recruiting for the Irish Civil Guard must be from the ranks of the IRA first, as stated in the Irish Independent 7th inst, and that under no circumstances will we tolerate the disbanded IRC in here that bore arms with the enemy up to the present day to suppress the national instinct of the Irish people. That we are satisfied to work with ex-RIC that resigned on principle and proved the sincerity of their principle by taking up their arms and fought with their brothers for the common cause, provided that such members can tell us what and where they fought and who was their OC. That we know several members of the IRA that were in active service during the war and who are both physically and mentally fit for the Civic Guard if it was worked on a proper basis. That since we came into this depot, our very best friends refused to recognize us since we degraded ourselves so much as to be associated with such dreadful characters as the RIC. And quote is from Brian McCarthy, The Civic Guard Mutiny. Even though Brennan assured the men he would forward their demands, he didn't. He felt that it was an internal squabble and paranoia that would blow over. He assured the men that the appointment of Kearney and other former RIC officers was only temporary. He then reported the demands to Staines. Staines responded by promoting Brennan, who the protesters seemed to trust, to the rank of assistant commissioner, placing him just below Staines and the deputy commissioner in rank. He also told Kearney that there was no way he could offer him a position in the Guard, and so Kearney and his family relocated to England. Staines also agreed to reach out to the protesters and consider their list of quote-unquote approved officers. He found them wanting and argued that he couldn't train a police force without, quote, the assistance of some kind of police. There were a number of things, such as execution of warrants, inquests, and other things that the RIC were accustomed to dealing with. End quote is from Brian McCarthy's book, The Civic Guard Mutiny. With the number of Guard members increasing to 1,000 in April, Staines needed a deputy commissioner to help him organize and train the men. The provisional government appointed former RIC District Inspector Patrick Walsh. He immediately organized the men into 8 companies and implemented a strict timetable of drills and classes. However, the training regime was the same as the RIC's training regime, angering officers like Liddy and Brennan. Liddy would later blame Staines for allowing Walsh to recreate the RIC and for allowing Collins to interfere with appointments to the Guard, often to the benefit of his allies or former squad members. Liddy may have been disappointed in Staines, but Staines was very angry with his other senior officer, Brennan. Staines believed that Brennan wasn't being polite enough to the former RIC colleagues and accused him of encouraging tensions between the former IRA members and the former RIC officers. This accusation was based on Brennan's insistence on eating in a different apartment instead of the officers' mess hall because non-commissioned officers, like Walsh, were using the officers' mess hall, which went against regulation. Brennan admitted this could create the perspective that he refused to eat with the former RIC officers, but in reality, he was just upholding regulations. He claimed that he didn't know that Walsh was a deputy commissioner, and if he had known, he wouldn't have complained, while Walsh said he didn't care where he got his meals. Brennan committed another faux pas when he refused to dine with Staines, Arthur Griffith, and his wife and children, and Eamon Duggan and his wife. Brennan claims he refused to eat because he thought only ex-RIC officers were invited to the dinner and that the former IRA officers were purposely excluded, which made him quite angry. He later admitted he, quote-unquote, misread the situation. These small misunderstandings may seem innocent to us, but in the tense situation in Kildare Barracks, which was the Civic Guard Barracks, these kinds of disagreements could turn into raging infernos. Part 1b, the anti-treaty response. As any insurgent will tell you, chaos is an insurgent's best friend. If a government cannot form simple organizations of control, like a police force, they will not be able to organize a proper response to the insurgents' attacks, lowering the citizens' trust in their government and making them more likely to look for an alternative. The anti-treaty forces often took pot shots at the members of the Civic Guard whenever they could, and they often tracked down and either intimidated or killed recruits. Then Roy O'Connor took the four courts, and an anti-treaty IRA officer, Thomas Daly, joined the Civic Guard with the express purpose of undermining it. With the help of a clueless Patrick Sellers, another Civic Guard member, Daly worked his way onto the protest committee. Sellers had no idea that Daly was in charge of a small number of anti-treaty officers and was in contact with O'Connor, awaiting instructions from the four courts. 1,100 guard recruits, along with 200 rifles and 1,000 revolvers, relocated to the Kildare artillery barracks on April 25, 1922. When they arrived, they had to clean out the barracks since the British used it as a stable and the officers couldn't find a safe place to turn into an armory. It was estimated a few days later that at least 400 revolvers and a large amount of ammunition went missing. A general parade was called, and officers insisted on the return of the revolvers. All but 10 were recovered. In May, it was announced that a majority of the 12 open high commissioned rank positions would be filled by former RIC men. Needless to say, this infuriated many of the former IRA members of the Guard. Capitalizing on this anger, Daly organized a new protest committee, with each company appointing 2 of their own officers to the committee. Only one company refused to take part. On May 12th, Daly and the new protest committee passed around a petition demanding, quote, the removal of the black and tans from the camp, even though no one in the barracks was a former black and tan member. Part 2. Mutiny. The mutiny started on May 15th during a training session when Daly and Sellers submitted an ultimatum to Staines. The ultimatum included 4 key points. 1. They objected to the 5 former RIC men who held high office in the Civic Guard. 2. They objected to the quote-unquote excessive influence the 5 men had over the commissioner. 3. They objected to the current training program, believing it was shaping the Guard into a new RIC. 4. They wanted the following officers expulsed despite the support they provided the IRA during the Irish War of Independence: Deputy Commissioner Patrick Walsh, Private Secretary Jeremiah Marr, Superintendent Edmund Prendeville, Superintendent James Brennan, Superintendent Bernard O'Connor. Staines responded to the ultimatum by calling a general parade at 2 p.m. that day. He waited 30 minutes after the men assembled to appear and address them. He claimed that it was, quote, apparent at once that some secret agitation had been fomented and what should have been a disciplined force was in the process of being converted into an unruly mob. It was at once apparent that some secret propaganda had been at work and that the unthinking men were being led away by some unscrupulous agency. Quote is from Brian McCarthy's book, The Civic Guard Mutiny. He defended the records of the men the committee wanted expulsed. He called each signatory of the ultimatum and had them stand in the center of the square and read their registration numbers. He asked the men if the matter was now closed and they could return to business at hand, but the leaders of the commission refused to step back into line. Staines told them to send their resignation and asked the men if they would stand by him or the committee. The men heckled him and broke ranks to stand with the protest committee. Staines claimed that the men were little more than a, quote, pack of hooligans, and dismissed the parade. As he retreated, Staines heard the men cry, quote, we'll stand by Paddy Brennan, convincing him that Brennan was somehow involved in the mutiny. It didn't help that Brennan didn't return from leave the day of the mutiny. He claimed that he had been staying with his sick mother and stayed the night per her request. He also denied having anything to do with the mutiny and that the men calling his name must have been a spur-of-the-moment thing. Chief Superintendent Michael Rain stayed with the men and successfully calmed them down and even won their loyalty, including the men who made up the commission. Rain asked them to reconsider the ultimatum, but 2 men, O'Meara and Healy, became agitated and asked for the expulsion of the 5 former RIC officers. Rain claimed that he used information provided by loyal IRC members. O'Meara claimed that Rain didn't fight straight, and Rain replied, quote, if I didn't fight straight, my bullets went straight. Rain eventually dismissed the parade and called on the committee members to remain to discuss matters further. Rain told them to submit a formal request and he would do his best to argue their case. The protest committee agreed to discuss the matter with the men, and Rain told them Staines would leave in the morning to report the situation to the government and ask them, quote, not to do anything drastic while Staines was away. As the party separated, a group of 100 upset recruits raided the armory, stealing 167 rifles and 243 revolvers from the stockpile of 200 rifles and 1,000 revolvers. Worried about their safety, Staines and the headquarters staff were protected by a special armed guard as a precautionary measure. The next day, May 16th, Staines ordered that Company 6, the only quote-unquote disciplined company, be sent to a vacant barracks at Newbridge to separate them from the mutineers. However, the protest committee got to the men of Company 6 first and prevented the transfer. Staines ordered Superintendent John Joseph Byrne to request military aid from the National Army. He and Walsh also wrote their resignations before traveling to Dublin. Staines explained his decisions as, quote, the situation was impossible and that the men allowed themselves to be influenced by a number of their comrades who were not amenable to reason. I left the depot and came to Dublin and reported the matter to the provisional government. Quote is from Brian McCarthy's book, The Civic Guard Mutiny. The government presented their own solution to the men's issues to Sellers and Daly. The solution included the request that the men write all of their complaints in writing and to restore the status quo in camp. Once these two conditions were met, the government would set up a national inquiry into the matter. Sellers and Daly returned to camp to discuss the government's terms to the other men, and Collins ordered Staines to return and reassert his authority. While negotiations occurred in Dublin, military reinforcements from the neighboring camp, Curragh, arrived in Kildare to find the arsenal emptied and distributed to the mutineers, and Chief Superintendent Michael Raine arguing with the rebel leaders over who truly controlled the barracks. Despite the complicated situation, the National Army and the Civic Guard did not fire at one another. Instead, the National Army returned to Curragh, and the mutiny was left to resolve itself. Brennan finally returned later that night and organized for the high-ranking officers to leave the camp and head towards Curragh Barracks. Staines, Daly, and Sellers returned to the barracks at 10:30 p.m., only for Staines to be refused entry. Sellers and Daly supported this decision, while Brennan argued that Staines was still the commandant and should be let in. Staines eventually returned to Dublin, and Brennan would later claim he never knew his orders had not been followed. On May 17th, the committee drafted a new set of orders, naming Brennan as the new commissioner, and declared their loyalty to the Civil Guard, the provisional government, and the Dáil Éireann. Brennan claimed that he had never been consulted about his sudden promotion, but he didn't reject it either. On May 18th, the committee predictably rejected the government's ultimatum, sending Brennan as their spokesperson. According to Brennan, he asked Staines to return to the barracks 10 times, but Staines refused, claiming he had resigned from the guard. The government repeated that if the mutineers had concerns about the guard, they would have to put in a formal request and an inquiry would be formed. Members of the commission grew frustrated with the stalemate and left the committee, leaving Daly and his fellow anti-treaty supporters to fill in the power vacuum that the others left behind. Raine and other men loyal to Staines and the provisional government locked themselves in Raine's quarters and prepared for an ambush. The mutineers tried to enter Raine's room, and when that failed, they prevented food from being delivered and prevented all communications between Raine and Staines. An officer escaped the barracks and reported to Staines, and an agreement was made where Raine and the other officers could leave. Sellers and Daly wrote a new request to the government, claiming that the government could ignore their previous demand. Instead, it was more of a quote-unquote informal request. However, they would only be willing to negotiate with the government if their request was met. Brennan brought the new request to Collins and Duggan, and Collins was furious. Matters were made worse when Staines claimed that Brennan was involved with the mutiny, which Brennan, of course, refuted. The meeting ended in a shouting match, and Brennan returned to the barracks, fearing government action. That night, Sellers and Daly wrote to Duggan, stating, quote, we hereby hand over the headquarters and depot of Civic Guard to the senior officer here at present, Co-Commandant P. Brennan. We formally withdraw the word demand on original document and respectfully request the Minister for Home Affairs to have the grievances of the men inquired into as soon as possible. In the future, we shall have our lawful grievances put forward in the proper manner. Quote is from Brian McCarthy's book, The Civic Guard Mutiny. Brennan formally accepted command of the barracks and reminded the men to remain loyal to the provisional government while this mess was sorted out. Collins paid a visit to the barracks on May 26th. He met with Brennan first and asked if he should meet with the committee first or with all the men. Brennan told him to speak to the committee and that to do his best to placate them. The negotiations between Collins and the committee was heated. They eventually agreed to return to the status quo. The committee agreed that they would allow Staines and others to return to the barracks. Collins then addressed the rest of the men and expressed his disappointment, criticized the leaders of the mutiny for their quote-unquote rash behavior, told the men that any complaints delivered through the proper channels would be looked into, and that the police force required the highest level of discipline than any other field of service. Even though an agreement was reached, the men in the barracks grew impatient when Staines and the others didn't return. They were ordered to return the arms stolen from the armory, but majority of the weapons were still unaccounted for. The reason Staines didn't return to Kildare Barracks was because he was recruiting a new civic guard in Dublin, claiming different warehouses to use as training facilities. A reporter caught wind of the story and published an article on May 22nd, angering the men in Kildare. To make matters more chaotic, some of the men who joined Staines' Dublin guard defected to the Kildare mutineers. While the new recruits infused the mutiny of new blood, the men had not been paid since early May, and they claimed Collins was purposely withdrawing their pay. Staines argued that he never received completed pay stubs, and thus could not process their payment. Sellers and Daly traveled back to Dublin to complain about the new civic guard and the delay in establishing an inquiry. They also demanded to be paid. Staines and Collins agreed to pay the men once Walsh and five other men performed a stock take of the whole barracks. Staines and his other officers arrived in front of Kildare Barracks on June 9th, but were denied access. Staines demanded to see Brennan, but big surprise, Brennan wasn't in the barracks. He was out to attend an anniversary for one of his former comrades in East Clare. Daly, Sellers, and Sergeant Sean O'Brien approached the gate and complained about the number of men Staines brought with him. They claimed that he broke the agreement, but Staines argued he would never have agreed to bring only five men with him. He claimed that Collins told him to, quote, bring down as many as you need, we'll leave it to yourself. After much arguing, Staines returned to Dublin once more and complained that Brennan was a liar, discipline was non-existent in the barracks, and the committee was in full control, not Brennan. Part 2A, General Elections and the Mutiny. Collins's Sinn Féin party won a majority of seats in the Dáil Éireann during the general elections. This forced the hands of the anti-treaty IRA. At 11 p.m., Daly and his fellow committee members took a number of rifles, revolvers, and ammunition, and took three tenders and a Ford car. Lynch, a loyal civic guard officer, was suspicious about the late-night call for cars, and so he joined Daly on his journey. Daly took him to his rendezvous location with Rory O'Connor. O'Connor tried to talk Lynch into joining the anti-treaty side, but Lynch was unmoved. His revolver was taken, officially making him a prisoner of the anti-treaty army. Daly returned to Kildare Barracks with anti-treaty soldiers who cleaned out the armory. An officer who saw Daly and the other soldiers, without Lynch, reported the situation to Brennan. He told Brennan he was worried that Lynch was a prisoner, and Brennan told him not to worry about it until the morning. Daly took the convoy with the weapons back to the cottage he was holding Lynch in. He told Lynch to stay in the cottage for an hour, and then he could leave. Lynch waited 15 minutes before walking back to Kildare, while Daly took the weapons to the four courts. Collins and Duggan returned to Kildare Barracks to negotiate with the mutineers one final time. The mutineers issued a statement explaining their reasons for rebelling, distancing themselves from the anti-treaty elements of the mutiny, and criticized the government for relying on the RIC to train the civic guard. They ended their statement by declaring loyalty to the people and the democratically elected government of Ireland. The government responded by promising to pay the men of Kildare Barracks and suspend the Kildare recruits until an inquiry could be held. Staines returned to Kildare Barracks on June 27th to arrange the necessary pay sheets for the men, but his efforts were hampered by the bombardment of the four courts. The men of Kildare Barracks waited for 2 weeks as the government assaulted the four courts and entered a civil war. The men grew anxious, and Brennan wrote to Collins on July 7th, claiming that the men were eager to be of service, and many were willing to temporarily transfer to the National Army to help fight the insurgents. Collins wrote back, thanking him for the gesture of loyalty, and the best service the men could provide the state was to become an efficient police force. Part 3, Formation of a Police Force, Take 2. The inquiry finally started on July 12th. Legal Secretary Kevin O'Shiel and Michael McAuliffe of the Labor Department went to Kildare Barracks to, quote, constitute a commission to investigate and report the provisional government as to the breaches of discipline and acts of insubordination alleged to have been committed recently by, and the complaints made on the part of, members of the Civic Guard. Brian McCarthy, the Civic Guard Mutiny. They were also instructed to provide any recommendations they had on the future structure of the Civic Guard. The creation of this commission was Collins's last act as chairman of the provisional government. Afterwards, he took the position of commander-in-chief of the National Army because of the Civil War, and William Cosgrave stepped in as chairman. He kept Collins informed as the commission submitted its findings. O'Shiel and McAuliffe opened the investigation on July 13th and ran into a speed bump on day one. Staines arrived to the commission prepared with witnesses, but there was no one to speak for the Civic Guard. Brennan refused to submit a list because he was quote-unquote neutral, and he claimed the men had no list of witnesses because they didn't know the commission was meeting that day, nor did they know what the commission would cover. Staines grew exasperated, and Brennan finally agreed to tell the men that they would need to submit a list of witnesses and advocate for themselves. O'Shiel adjourned the commission until the next day. He told Brennan to make sure to post a notice about the commission on the Kildare and Newbridge Barracks notice boards. The commission reopened on July 14th. Deputy Commissioner Walsh represented Staines, and Guard John O'Connell represented the Civil Guard. Staines' statement defended many of his decisions based on the need for expediency and lack of police experience amongst the members of the IRA. He also blamed Brennan for not supporting him properly. He even claimed that Brennan knew the mutiny beforehand, and that's why he was missing on May 15th and purposely quote-unquote disappeared on June 9th. June 9th was when Staines was supposed to go back to the barracks to gather information for the pay stubs, but they refused him entrance. After O'Connell cross-examined Staines, Walsh called Barrack Master McCarthy to testify to the theft of Civic Guard arms and Commandant Rain to provide further information on what happened on May 15th. Walsh sat as a witness for the next day, July 15th, and argued that Collins himself asked Walsh to help Staines create the Civic Guard. O'Connell took the stand next and read a prepared statement that hadn't been signed by anyone specifically, but the commission accepted as representative of the mutineers. It repeated the men's concerns about having RIC officers involved in creating a Irish police force, their fears about serving in the IRC under a different name, and blamed Staines for boorishly mishandling a delicate situation, exasperating mistrust and anger. As the statement tried to dismantle the government's rationale of needing experienced policemen to create a police force, the author sounds almost offended. Quote, "We have ideas of our own, and we wish to develop and apply them, within reason, unfettered by RIC rules and codes and regulations. To keep the peace and to enforce law and order in this nation, it will be obligatory on us to be bone of the bone of the people, and flesh of their flesh, and mind of their mind. Otherwise we shall be, from the outset, suspected by them. In time we shall be distrusted, and eventually we shall be ostracized and hated." End quote is from Brian McCarthy, the Civic Guard Mutiny. And there may be some truth to that, because if you remember from season one, when I was talking about the Irish War of Independence, one of the first things that Sinn Féin did, and the IRA followed their example, was to ostracize the men of the RIC. And that was really kind of one of the first steps to undermining England's control of Ireland. So there is a precedence, and the IRA would know that very well, because they're the ones that took part in that precedence. So the men ended their statement by admitting that they had been undisciplined in their efforts, but not wrong. They distanced themselves from Daly and professed their loyalty to the Irish government and its people. Seller and Liddy spoke next in defense of the men, admitting that the actions of the men were undisciplined and extreme, but justifiable considering the circumstances. Liddy also acknowledged that Rain's decision to stand by the Commandant was probably the, quote, proper stance to take. Guard John O'Meara and Sergeant Patrick Dole spoke next. Through his cross-examination, Walsh proved that the men didn't have a firm or unified idea of who qualified as a, quote-unquote, unacceptable ex-RIC officer and who didn't. As McAuliffe put it, they, the men, simply took things more or less into their own hands. You will agree it is an obviously unfair thing to accuse men and take a certain line of action against them. Men, like Superintendent Marr, who it transpires has a very good national record. and Mar was one of the men that the commission wanted to be expulsed from the forces. But turns out Mar actually had a very long and successful career as fighting for Irish liberation. So it was kind of like a weird request. Two of O'Connell's witnesses, Sergeant Patrick Coy and Sergeant McNamara, refused to answer Walsh's questions because he was a former DI for the IRC. He ignored his nationalistic record during the War of Independence, even though Walsh constantly brought it up and he brought up his connection with Collins. Losing patience, O'Shiel and McAuliffe closed the commission given the obstinance of O'Connell's own witnesses. O'Shiel traveled to Dublin that night and reported to the government, quote, "There is a state of grave insubordination and lack of discipline among the men, that, as at present, the civic guard could not, in his opinion, be organized into a competent police force. In the circumstances, it was not now possible to utilize the civic guard for police duties in certain areas as suggested by the commander-in-chief in his letter." End quote is from Brian McCarthy's book, The Civic Guard Mutiny. Brennan, who predictably had been elsewhere during the first 2 days of the commission, complained to Collins that he had not had a chance to defend himself. O'Shiel and McAuliffe held a special commission for him on July 21st. Brennan didn't know this, but his fate had already been decided. Cosgrave wrote to Collins arguing that no matter the outcome of the special commission, it would be best if, quote, "Mr. P. Brennan might be transferred to other work. Military governors for jails will be required, as well as officers to meet the wounded at railway terminals." Quote is from Brian McCarthy's book, The Civic Guard Mutiny. The special commission finished on July 22nd, and it was now up to O'Shiels and McAuliffe to provide a report to the provisional government. The report was submitted on August 17th, 5 days after the death of President Arthur Griffith. O'Shiel and McAuliffe agreed with Staines on all 9 of his complaints and agreed that Brennan's decision to remain in the barracks after the May 15th incident and engage with the mutineers only made matters worse. However, the report criticized Staines for leaving the barracks and for forcing the men to choose a side on the parade field. They also wrote that arming the civic guard was a terrible idea as it created a militant force and allowed men to settle grievances through their own means. It basically just continued the mindset of a soldier and not a police officer. While the report sympathized with the men's fears about the resurrection of the IRC, it argued that the main source of discontentment was external propaganda and internal sabotage by the anti-treaty forces. They also wrote that all former RIC officers who joined the Civic Guard had either quit the IRC to join the IRA or remained within the RIC because they were ordered to by IRA officers. They recommended the disbandment of the Civic Guard, but expressed no reasons to prevent former Civic Guard members from enrolling in the new police force. They would just have to receive approval from a 3-man selection committee to do so. The report went on and recommended that the new police force consisted of, one, the advice of experienced police officers from America, France, and Germany for a 3 to 5 year period. The government should also retain Patrick Walsh in a non-commissioned position to help with the training. Two, elected and former elected officials could not serve in the new police force. All volunteers would be kept on for a probation period of 1 year so that their character and their loyalty could be assessed. During this period, the volunteers would be encouraged to study for the rank they wanted, to expedite training, and to keep the men occupied. 4. Only ex-IRA men could serve in the most senior positions of HQ, while each officer's chief assistant should be an ex-IRC or DMP. That way they could combat the anti-treaties propaganda about recreating the RICs, but also benefit from the former police officer's experience. 5. The new police force would be divided into 3 different sections. The main body that would be deployed all over the country. They were the primary source of peacekeeping. They would be unarmed. And it was expected that their lack of weapons would win over the people and dissuade the anti-treaty forces from attacking them. A smaller armed reserve force under direct command of the commissioner. This force would be deployed in absolute emergencies. And then there was a section, a liaison department, that would manage relationships between the local council authorities and the new police force to manage the deployment of the armed reserves. They also recommended the creation of a detective force, but it would be under the joint control of the commissioner for the new police force and the commissioner of the DMP. 6. There should be a policing journal where policing knowledge could be shared while also encouraging literacy and study within the police force. 7. A review of the salaries for the new police force so the government could avoid a situation where they were bribing men to remain loyal. and 8. The following clause added to the existing oath of loyalty: to obey the orders of all superior officers appointed by the elected government of the people of Ireland. The provisional government read their recommendations and agreed to the following. 1. They shared the report confidentially with Commissioner Staines. They asked Staines to resign since he was a democratically elected official and thus couldn't serve in the civic guard. They wanted to appoint Commandant Sean O'Murthal as commissioner. They had a deal with Brennan and Liddy. Then they would technically disband the civic guard, but not disperse them. They had to rearrange for the select re-enrollment of members of the civic guard, and then they would send the new civic guard on police duty ASAP. This decision was made the same day that Collins died. And then someone shared a confidential document revealing that the IRC men who disbanded with the force were receiving higher pensions and salaries than the former IRA members. They were also receiving higher pensions and salaries than the ex-RIC officers who resigned. So basically, the IRC officers who remained with the force and then joined the Civic Guard were being rewarded for staying with the RIC. The IRC officers who left the force during the Irish War of Independence, willingly, they resigned, fought the IRA, and then joined the Civic Guard, were not being rewarded. They weren't getting paid, but they weren't getting a pension. And then the IRA officers who fought during the Irish War of Independence and then joined the Civic Guard were being paid less than any of the RIC officers. When this was revealed, it was like a bombshell, and Cosgrave was being warned that there was going to be another mutiny. To prevent that, he immediately went to action. He implemented the commissioner's recommendations, he formally disbanded the Civic Guard, and he created a new police force under the command of the fascist Éowyn O'Duffy. We'll have to get into O'Duffy at some point, but he was a fascist, he supported both Mussolini and Hitler, he volunteered to send troops to Ethiopia when Mussolini invaded it. If you want to learn more about that, yeah, join the book club. O'Duffy's a mess. But at this point, everyone still trusts him. So O'Duffy won the respect of the new police force and effectively implemented the commission's recommendations. This police force is now known as Garda Síochána. Even if the men were still upset about the entire mutiny and the pay differences, they didn't really have time to take action, as the provisional government was determined to establish control over the entire country. And also, reviewing the pay scale was supposed to be part of the commission's recommendations that the government agreed to, so at some point they were going to do that as well. The first batch of unarmed officers were sent into the Irish countryside during the last 2 weeks of September. So yeah, think this through, right? May, the Four Courts is bombed. The anti-treaty forces, they disappear from Four Courts. Some of them get arrested, some of them run away. They are now fighting a guerrilla war. Well, they try to take a couple stands at Cork and some other places, find out that that doesn't work for them, so then they go into guerrilla warfare mode. August, Griffith and Collins die. Griffith dies of, I think it's a heart attack. Collins dies because he's murdered. He's assassinated. The Garda, the new force, they don't have weapons, and they are being sent into the Irish countryside. The same place where Collins was killed, and the same place where National Army are fighting the anti-treaty soldiers. And the National Army is actually pulling back from some barracks because they don't have enough men to cover the barracks, police the areas, and fight the anti-treaty soldiers. So the Garda has to enter those barracks, enter these places that the National Army can't hold because the National Army needs to make progress against the anti-treaty forces, hold those places, win people's support, and resist anti-treaty forces that are still in the area, all unarmed. Before they left, O'Duffy gathered them on the parade grounds and told them, quote, "You're going out unarmed into a hostile area. You are the first to be sent out. You may be murdered, your barracks burned, your uniform taken off you, but you must carry on and bring peace to the people." Quote is from Brian McCarthy, The Civic Guard Mutiny. About 1,700 police officers took their place around the country between September and October 1922. In many cases, they were intimidated and harassed by the anti-treaty forces, their possessions stolen, their lives threatened, and their barracks attacked and or raided. But most of the men refused to flee or quit the force. As the National Army withdrew from barracks throughout the country and focused on truly military affairs, the new police force frantically increased their recruiting efforts. Of course, this led to hardly any time to train the new recruits, and there were many farcical incidences where officers would try to perform their duties, but they didn't understand police procedure, so they'd be like standing there with an arrested person, and they wouldn't know how to process them. So, not a very smooth transition to a new police force, but they were trying. As the Civil War wound to an end, O'Duffy was able to address the lack of training. He implemented required exams. He relied on Walsh's expertise to establish an effective training regime, and he created the Garda's own magazine, Iris on Garda. In the first issue, O'Higgins addressed the guards, quote, "The internal politics and political controversies of the country are not your concern. You will serve with the same imperturbable discipline and with increasing efficiency any executive which has the support of the majority of the people's elected representatives. Party will no doubt succeed party in the ebb and flow of the political tide. New issues will arise to convulse the nation. The landmarks of today will disappear. You will remain steadfast and devoted in the service of the people and of any executive which it may please the people to return to power. That is the real meaning of democracy, government of the people, by the people, through their elected representatives. It is the only barrier between mankind and anarchy." Quote is from Brian McCarthy's book, The Civic Guard Mutiny. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. You can listen to my full catalog on Spotify, iTunes, and my website, www.samswarroom.com. Don't forget to sign up for the Around the World Book Club. We're reading The Shadow King by Maza Menjais for March. Shadow King, again, is about Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia in 1935. Please join my Patreon, www.patreon.com/AOAwarfare, now, and you'll receive a special Around the World Book Club sticker. Until next time, wear a mask, demand a ceasefire in Palestine, and stay safe.